With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
You've heard us say it before. The 2020 presidential election was met with record voter turnout. Several states across the country made it easier for Americans to cast their vote amid the deadly coronavirus pandemic.
The entire system of elections in the United States is, for the most part, set around the whole construct of having all the foxes guard the hen house. Because if all the foxes are guarding the hen house, then they're not going to let some other fox go grab those eggs. And so understand there's a context to elections that in most cases, in most places, works very well because you've got strong partisans from both sides or multiple sides.
Welcome to Dead Men Don't Vote.
So we're here to ensure the right to vote will be preserved.
The podcast where you, the American voter, have the opportunity to understand how elections really work and how you can help improve the process and restore confidence in American democracy. We will interview leading election experts, explore election controversies, and demystify election administration, from voter registration to ballot casting and counting, results reporting, and on through to certification and audits. We'll answer all your burning questions. Is vote by mail safe? How are foreign countries trying to interfere in our elections? And yes, do dead people actually vote? And we hope you will listen, like the future of our country depends on it.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, Anna.
If country borders and grids can fascinate you, and state names intrigue you, if atlases, globes, city plans, subway maps, and of course, world maps are your thing, if you can name the capital city of Namibia, and if you get giddy about flags, you are in the right place. This is Map Corner, a podcast about the love of maps brought to you by Royfield Brown and Claire Asprey. Now, on with the show.
Hello and welcome to Map Corner. I'm Royfield Brown, who is back in California, which means I'm 38.6 degrees north and 122.14 minutes west, which means I'm in Vallejo and I'm with Claire Asprey. Now, Claire, I don't know why we even have this bit on the script, but I'm supposed to ask you, where are you today?
Well, unsurprisingly, I'm at 52.1 degrees north and 0.5 degrees east in Bedfordshire, in Clapham. But I'm particularly grateful right now that I'm allowed to leave the house because I have COVID in the house. But I don't yet have COVID, so I'm allowed to go out, which I don't know how long that's going to last. So, you know, I'm just very appreciative of being able to leave the front door right now.
So you're going to abandon your daughter to the ravages of this pernicious
disease? Well, she's not really had any symptoms yet. It's been like 3 days and you wouldn't even... If it wasn't for a testing, we wouldn't know she had it. So, you know.
Bit like me when I was due to jump on my plane and 24 hours beforehand, just 3 weeks ago, they said, you're not going on a plane to America because you have COVID. And I felt as right as rain. But folks, you'd only hear about my travel woes. Map Corner is the podcast dedicated to the love of maps and to all things cartophilic. So if Peters is your projection, you're in the right place.
And in this episode, we're really pleased to be talking to Professor Joni Seeger, who's the author and compiler of The Women's Atlas, which is a fantastic book.
And we have an audio postcard from Pat Hanavan, our very own Pat, who's not with us today. Hopefully she'll join us later. Don't forget to review us on Apple Podcasts or on other podcast platforms.
And once again, we're recording with some of our Map Corner listeners. If you want to join in the next broadcast, do join the Facebook group to get the details. We post those on every time. And if you're not on the Facebook, then send us a message via Twitter or via email to get the link for next month's show.
We will be recording the first Saturday every month at 6 p.m. UK time, which is 1 p.m. Eastern, which unfortunately for us in the Pacific means that it's 10 a.m. Now, today, we are interviewing Joni Seeger, who is all manner of awesome. Claire, why don't you start proceedings with our wonderful guest?
Okay, so we're all talking about the Girl Power Day and the Women's Atlas and really understanding the world through gender eyes, I think. And one thing I really love about the Women's Atlas that Joni put together is it just contains such a wealth of information. It's got maps, it's got infographics, it's got stats, it's got the whole lot. So Joni, how did you come to put it together?
Oh, hi. Thank you. I'm so glad to be here and with all of you online. Thank you for inviting me. And I actually have to say, I didn't know about this podcast until Claire contacted me many months ago. And it's like very exciting that you have this podcast. So good on you. Thank you.
Well, Joni, just before you start, right, if you're going to pay us a compliment, have you written us a 5-star review?
Not.
She will after this, though.
I actually just wrote it down. You can't see. I wrote Apple Podcast on my notepad here. So how did this start? This started when I was a graduate student in geography a long time ago. Let's just leave it at that. And in my non-school identified life, I was very involved in feminist movements and political movements. And then I would come to the university and it's as though the entire feminist movement, we're talking about the 1980s, I'll give you that much, just didn't exist. You know, that is like there was no uptake of anything about gender or women or what was then called women's studies or women's issues at my postgraduate program at university in geography. Geography was very late to cut. It was one of those really intransigent and very male-dominated disciplines that came very late to looking at genders, what we now call gender stuff. So a friend and I, also in postgraduate school, we got really fed up one day. And actually, we were inspired by a series of atlases that perhaps many of you know. It was from a small London-based press called Pluto Press, doing a lot of labor publishing. And they put out an atlas called State of the World Atlas. Does anyone remember those? State of the World? Amazing. Yeah. All right. We got one or two takers here. So the thing about the State of the World Atlas was that it was paperback. It was inexpensive. It had amazingly bright colors and amazingly diverse and radical topics. And when I, as a geographer, saw this atlas, it's like, oh, yes, this is what an atlas should be. It shouldn't be this big, heavy tome that you pull down from the bottom shelf. And it's always an atlas of trains or wine or explorers. You know, and there was this kind of like popular pitch to the general public, really engaging atlas was fantastic. And my friend and I said, wow, at first we said, oh, wow, they need to do a women's atlas in this same kind of spirit. And then that eventually became, over just a few beers, that became, oh, we should do this Women's Atlas. And through friends of friends, we were put in touch with Pluto Press. And eventually Pluto Press, the Atlas series, went to a wonderful, wonderful publisher called Myriad Editions based in Brighton. So that was how it all started. It was actually frustration out of not seeing women anywhere in my kind of professional domains of thinking about geographies. So that's how it all started.
And then we've got lots of information in. So how do you decide which topics to cover? Because it's everything from politics to climate change to, you know, things right. that are very home-based to things that are very sort of multinational. There's a whole load of different range of things there. How do you whittle that down?
Well, I mean, that's actually kind of a really important part of what we do and the tussling we have with our editors. But essentially, a lot of work such as this would start from data sources and say, okay, let's figure out where the data are and let's map it. We started the other way and said, what do we want to know about women's lives? And then we'll figure out how we're going to show it. So we do have the kind of the chapter divisions, not that it makes a great deal of sense, but the chapter divisions include things such as body politics, you know, sports and beauty and prostitution and trafficking, So it's like body politics and work and education and power. Of course, it's all about power, but that in a formal institutional sense, and around reproductive rights and reproductive issues. And one of my favorite awful sections is called Keeping Women in Their Place, which is looking at the social and institutional mechanisms by which women are often literally kept in their place. So we started from a kind of broad spectrum of what goes on for women, and indeed for men, in their everyday lives. And then let's figure out how we can include it in the Atlas, which is not easy because, you know, some stuff has pretty straightforward data correlates. So if you want to know women in institutions, you know, so percent of women in governments, you know, bingo, got that data. You wanted to know women in the UN, bingo, got that information. Women school teachers, yeah, easy. But what can you map about the broad ranging concepts such as beauty and the extent to which norms of beauty, which women are supposed to aspire to, what can you map about that? I mean, we could talk about it forever, but what can be mapped? And in fact, in that instance on beauty and the kind of driving construction of kind of normalized beauty, what very Western visions of what women's beauty is or should be. And for that, we use surrogates. So I think the map includes cosmetics. It includes the cosmetics industry. It includes the winners of international beauty contests, which I think is not actually all that interesting, although it does show geographic clustering. So for a lot of the information that we wanted to show, starting from the position of what do we want to show about women's lives, for a lot of it, we have to use hopefully clever and interesting surrogates because there's not an actual data set that captures it.
And this is, I think, the fifth edition. So I'm interested, have you chosen different things? What's gone in over time? What's got lost over time? How has the data changed in that time?
You know, it's interesting. I actually should go back and do a kind of side-by-side content check, and I haven't done that. I mean, in general, I would say what's changed is as our social realms have changed, looking at women's organizing and the Me Too movement and much more intersectional analysis of the overlays of race and ethnicity and sexuality and women's identity in the broadest sense. Also, I would say one of the newer domains, which I'm very keen on, partly because I do work in it in my other life, is environmental issues. So this is, in previous editions of the Atlas, we've had a little bit on what you might call environment. In this one, we have more clearly environmental topics such as malaria or a chemical pollution and drinking water. And one of my favorites, toilet activism, you know, the what's called, particularly coming out of India, the right to pee movement. Can we say that on the podcast, the right to pee?
We prefer, because we're British English speakers here. But we'll accept P.
All right. So, which is a really interesting movement, the kind of toilet rights movement, I think is fascinating. And it comes out of women's activism. And those of us who are women know that whenever you're about in any urban setting, there are no women's toilets, or there's one, and the line is always six times as long as the men's toilet. That is, the toilet provision for women is, you know, it might be a very, you know, seemingly pressing inconvenience for us if we're at a concert or whatever. But for many women in many urban environments, it's a real health and public rights threat to just not have any toilets available. So I love that movement around urban environments and toilets, and kind of adopting that as a feminist, or the foregrounding of that as a feminist issue.
I'm going to ask a two-part question. So there's a few editions of the book. Is there one metrics which you've maybe had from the start, which you're noticing a regression in terms of women's activity or access to? And then kind of, you know, I had a brief look at the book, and I love maps because I love colors and shapes. Tell us, so the second part is, how important was it for you to be in part, to be really involved with the process of how to put all the infographics together, because they really do suck you in. So first, have we seen a regression? And then tell us about your involvement in physically how the book actually looks.
Yeah, great questions. In terms of regression, sitting here, particularly, I would say right now in the United States, like, please let me out of here. But the challenges to women's reproductive rights is, particularly in the US, is kind of astonishing. And one of the things that underscores is that the rights of any group that's not particularly well entrenched in halls of power, those rights are always fragile. And, you know, we think we've achieved a certain position, social position, or certain rights. But you have to keep your eye on it, and you have to keep your activism up, because there are very powerful forces that want to use the expression of one of my chapters, keep women in their place. And certainly the rollback of women's reproductive rights, I mean, they're in Europe, the Poland struggles, the struggles of Polish women, certainly in the US. And in many countries now, we see that governments remain kind of implacably uninterested in the oppression of indigenous women, whether you're talking about Canada to the Maquiladora women in Mexico to the Yazidi women in Iraq. Governments are still very reluctant to put protections in place for minority groups. So I would say there certainly are regressions, particular regressions, and in some ways, again, particularly thinking about the US right now, overall regressions, which I'd love to...
One of the things that stood out to me about one of the maps, which is the child marriage in the USA map.
Yes, like, shocking.
The figures there were... Oh my God, like right. 10-year-olds getting married. And it's really, it's just basically a way of legitimizing rape, isn't it?
It absolutely is.
Like, I hadn't really appreciated the extent of child marriage in the USA. I mean, comparatively kind of, you know, right. modern Western society. But yeah, it was a real eye-opener. Which well, is, again, it's all about prioritizing the rights of the unborn child to be in a yep. legal marriage, rather than yep. the rights of the child who is pregnant, which is horrific.
I'm just pulling up that page, because I was shocked too. Now, the numbers, the actual absolute numbers, are not that large, but it's shocking that child marriage happens at all in the US. As I started to look into this, and there are a couple of activist groups, very good activist groups in the US that are really trying to put this issue on the front burner and keep it there. One of the drivers of girl child marriage in the US and elsewhere is that, well, one of the overall drivers is that men and boys should have access to women sexually, but that reproduction should happen in the context of marriage. And so I just wanted to tell you this little story. It's in the book. So very short paragraph. In 2017, a 17-year-old Girl Scout, I think you'd call her a Girl Guide, started a legislative campaign in New Hampshire to raise New Hampshire's minimum age of marriage to 18. In fact, it was a much lower marriage, and some states don't have a minimum age of marriage. What is it in the UK? What's the minimum age of marriage?
16.
16 with consent, with parental consent, I think.
And then without. Okay, so this young woman wanted to raise New Hampshire to state in the U.S., wanted to raise the minimum marriage age to 18. Republican representatives in the New Hampshire legislature killed the bill. And here's one of them commenting on why he voted against this bill. Quote, "If we pass this, we will ensure forever that every child born to a minor will be born out of wedlock." So his concern was that young girls who become pregnant should only be pregnant in the context of marriage. Therefore, we can marry off young girls. And it's like, when I heard that, it was like, are you kidding me? But it's kind of circular logic that, well, if young girls are, as you say, Claire, essentially raped and become pregnant, then they should be marriageable, and they should be married, and they should be marriageable. And this kind of circular logic is really scary. And I think you'll find that in many of the opposition to closing down early marriages, the sense of, oh, but then what would we do with the pregnant girls? Like, well, let's start by asking why they're pregnant in the first place at age 14 or 15 or 16. We could go on about that, but should I go back to Royfield?
Yeah, no, go on to Royfield's second question. Yeah, design. Yeah. It is great. Yeah, the design is fantastic.
And I give full credit for that to the wonderful designers at Myriad Editions. And we worked very closely. I mean, as you might guess or be able to tell, I'm a person of fairly strong opinions about information and how it's presented. So I would often, when I would send in a manuscript for a topic, I would often say, well, I think we should show it this way, and perhaps we should do this. And sometimes I was right, and sometimes I was wrong, and sometimes they agreed, and sometimes they didn't. But the designers would then pick it up, and we would actually... We had a really great relationship. Many of these people have been my friends for many years now, having published with them over a long period of time. And so we would have fairly kind of continuous back and forths. And, you know, sometimes we'd tussle a little bit about it. I go, oh, no, that looks terrible. Or they'd say, oh, no, we can't do that. But it was actually a very amicable and lovely process to think about how to display the information in its best form. And often that form, as you said, Clara Royfield, you know, there are a lot of maps in this book, but there are a lot of them are infographics too. And so where we have, going back to one of the comments I made earlier about partial data being available or only some kind of indication of data being available, where that was the case, we'd often put it on infographic. Because if you have a global map and you can only apply color to six countries, it looks kind of dorky, not very effective. So in that occasion, we turned to infographics. So the book kind of goes back and forth between, or combines both, infographics as well as more conventional maps. And I really have come to love infographics. I think they're very, as mapping is, I think it's very democratizing, because people can look at an infographic who feel they have no specialist knowledge and they can get something from it. And same thing with mapping. You know, I've had very early grade school teachers tell me they use the atlas in their classes. And it's like, not entirely sure that's a great idea for young children. But it's because as a non-specialist, and even as perhaps a youngish grade school child, you can look at a map and if you just start by saying, why are all those countries red or all of those countries are green? You know, what's the similarity, what's the difference? And I think that the visual display of information encourages that kind of curiosity, and it doesn't set up quite as high a barrier to people who are not specialists. You can say, come on in, you can look at this map, and we can all get information from this. And that's often the case with infographics too. It's kind of a very, I say, opening and democratizing way of getting information, I think, or I hope.
Could not agree with you more. And on that note, what we have to do is go to our second section, which is our audio postcard, which for the lucky people who are part of this live recording, it's of course a video postcard. This is the Bay of Fundy, and this is by
Perfect
Hanavan.
My audio postcard is from my favorite geographic feature, the Bay of Fundy, home of the highest tides on Earth. The Bay of Fundy is the long, narrow body of water that separates the Canadian provinces of New Brunswick and Nova Scotia. The bay is about 150 kilometers long and 52 kilometers wide at its entrance, which is just about at the border between Maine and New Brunswick on the north side and the western end of Nova Scotia on the south. The bay gets a bit narrower and eventually splits into two arms at its top, the southern one forming Minas Basin. That's where the highest tides are. There, at the head of the Bay of Fundy, high tide can be 17 meters above low tide. That's the height of a five-story building. It's dramatic, and you can see it happen as you watch. A boat that's sitting on mud when you go into a store to do your shopping can be floating and ready to sail away by the time you come out. And the power of the water coming in and going out is awe-inspiring. In just over 12 hours, about 110 billion tons of water flows in and then back out of the Bay of Fundy. That's equivalent to the flow of all the waters of the world for 24 hours. Those big tides happen thanks to something called tidal resonance. That's what happens when the amount of time it takes a large wave to travel from the mouth of a bay to the far shore and back to the mouth is the same, or nearly the same, as the time between the high and low tides. The Bay of Fundy happens to be just the right length, so that by the time the water drains out completely, it's almost exactly the moment that the tide starts to come in again, a little like the water sloshing back and forth in a bathtub. The indigenous people of the region, the Mi'kmaq, have a legend about Fundy's great tide. The legendary creator and hero Glooskap wanted to take a bath. Glooskap commanded Beaver to build a dam at the mouth of the bay to trap the water for his bath. Whale was angry about this and demanded to know what stopped the flow of the water. Glooskap, not wanting to annoy Whale, instructed Beaver then to break the dam. But Whale was impatient. He began to break away at the dam with his tail, and these great movements set Fundy's waters in motion. The power of the water is so great that at the top of the bay, it pushes water the wrong way up the rivers, then drags it out again. The incoming upstream wave is called a tidal bore. There are tidal bores on the Petit Kodiak River in New Brunswick and on the Salmon and Shubenacadie Rivers in Nova Scotia. The tidal bores make an exciting raft ride. Hop into your raft and you don't even have to paddle. Just ride out on the outgoing tide and right back in on the wave of the tidal bore. That was our older daughter Louise's bachelorette party. Another fun activity that I don't do is race the tides. If you're a runner, maybe you'd like to run the Not Since Moses, which is a 5 or 10 kilometer race across what is basically the ocean floor. The race goes from 5 islands in the Minas Basin near the top of the bay. And the challenge is, it's muddy. Of course, you don't have to race other runners. If you prefer to walk, you can take a carefully timed hike on the Fundy floor in many places near the top of the bay. And you're only racing the tide to get back. I haven't had the nerve yet. I have, however, visited the Joggins Fossil Cliffs, now a UNESCO World Heritage Site. There in the cliffs along the Fundy Beach, you can see the geological layers almost in diagram form, and you see perfectly fossilized plants and animals, sometimes with their dens or footprints and food, including some animal species found nowhere else. My daughter Louise and her family now live in Wolfville, a college town that's also on the Minas Basin. As I record this, I'm planning to fly to Halifax tomorrow, and by the next day, I'll be in Wolfville, sitting on the dock, watching the tide roll.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications at TryLifeMD.com? We're now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
It's fun to put on jeans that you couldn't get into 6 months ago.
Every morning, I look forward to getting on the scale.
For anybody who's struggling with their weight, it's a godsend.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
away.
Thank you, Pat Hanavan, for that. I didn't know anything about the Bay of Fundy. It was utterly a kind of a moment of exploration for me in the kind of educational sense. So thank you for that, Pat. And we will tell you, good listener, how you can actually send us in an audio postcard later on in the show. But Joni, we need to come back onto you. So what edition is the Atlas at right now?
Five.
Right. So five.
Everyone painful. I mean, great when it's done, but the doing of it is.
How long did it take to put a next edition together?
Years.
Yeah, I mean. Yeah.
Yeah, from
say, I love that audio postcard. I love that it's a feature of this podcast. It's really great. And as I said, just as we were getting going, I'm Canadian, so I did know about the Bay of Fundy, but I loved the visuals. And coincidentally, just yesterday, I was talking to a friend about why collectively we're not tapping more tidal power. And so I'm now especially curious about whether there are tidal energy systems being developed around the Bay of Fundy. So doubly interesting. Thank you.
It's the most powerful tidal system in the world, and it funnels more water than all the ones combined. I found that to be a stunning bit of, you know, in
me too.
What amazing results, like you say, Jenny, like if you can capture the energy of that. Why are we still doing old style power stations?
Oh yeah. Now that's a whole other thing we need to talk about.
But I tell you what we do need to talk about is getting our good listeners, or dare I say viewers, on this Zoom call into this chat. So if you have a question for Joni, why don't you unmute yourself, unburden yourself by being mute, and be vocal and throw a question in. And just whilst you're maybe girding your loins for a question, Pat Graves says there are several tidal bores along the Alaskan Peninsula as well. Yeah, I would have thought so, looking at that jagged coastline. But I don't quite understand tides, and I don't understand, even though it was so explained in the video, just the sheer amount of water just beggars belief, which is going backwards and forwards and so fast as well. So fast that one of the videos which I did see was, which I didn't include on this, was three people just stood in the water for 45 minutes. And by the end of it, so they start with just by their toes, in 45 minutes, they're almost submerged. It moves so fast. But anyway, if you've got a question, please unmute yourself and jump in, because this podcast needs the brain's trust, because Claire and I just aren't clever enough to ask good, great questions. So Ken, Nick, et al., please join us. And thank you, Jan Mitchell, for joining us. I think it's your first time also. In terms of, so if you're on your fifth edition, Joni, what editorial decisions are you making, let's say, throughout the year to maybe add or subtract away from the book? You know, what are those considerations?
Yeah, actually, I'm not right now thinking about the next edition. I'm kind of taking a relief break. But it's always in the back of my mind. And one of the things that's always kind of tantalizing is that we really should have an online edition of this that's easily updatable, because some of the very specific information, well, let me start again. The broad topics, whoa, interesting view. The broad topics remain more or less steady across editions, but the specific information, of course, changes. I mean, changes almost literally every day. And I'm not so worried about that, because even if some of the very specific data points are out of date or need to be, or would be different if you did it now, again, the purpose of this atlas is kind of to put broad concepts forward. So, but on the other hand, it would be really great to have super up-to-date information and data. That would take a small team to put online and to keep it updated. And if anyone wishes to fund a small team on an ongoing basis to do so, be in touch. I mean, it'd be quite an arduous, quite compelling project, I think. So that's one of the things that I, you know, I'll be reading the paper, listening to the radio, and there'll be some change in, you know, in new findings about health conditions in a country, or, you know, disasters. For example, I was just, I've been paying a lot of attention to the disaster in Tonga, the volcanic disaster in Tonga, and wondering how that's rippling through Tongan society differently for many classes of people, including men and women. And it would be great to be able to update that, but that's not possible right now. It's just a stream in my head right now.
Gotcha.
And I think some of that stuff is so new as well. I mean, I really like the bits in this edition, which were around sort of digital activity, yeah. People who had access to a mobile phone or the internet, a whole load of stuff around, you know, people who are now banking online in a way that, you know, they were the whole sort of parts of the world where they haven't gone through the like, traditional banking structures, and they've just gone straight into some sort of like online banking and currency exchange on phones. But obviously access to the hardware and the internet connection is such an important element of that. And again, that unsurprisingly reflects power and control and wealth and gender. And, you know, but that's such a dynamic picture because, you know, the reach of the internet is, you know, it's so exponential. Yeah. Trying to pick a moment in time for a book, it's going to be so different in a year's time.
Totally different.
And certainly over the pandemic, it's driven so much different sort of engagement online too.
But I'm glad you picked that up, Claire, the business about online connectivity or mobile phone connectivity. And also I would say we have to add in access to electricity as one of the preconditions for being fully able to take advantage of internet. It's not only the hardware and the literacy and the access, but there's also electricity. But there are huge gender gaps in many parts of the world in access and use, access to and use of mobile phones. And, you know, I do a lot of international work and what might be called broadly international development work. And there's always kind of this trope that's going around about, well, it's so great. Mobile phones have now penetrated. That's always the language on them. Penetrated, you know, everywhere, even in the poorest world. And it's like, well, yes. And it is true that, as you say, Claire, in some ways, in many communities, have kind of skipped over traditional communication systems straight into mobile. But then you dig down a little bit, and there are huge gender gaps. So when enthusiastically, it's often companies involved in consumer activity, they go, oh, but, you know, everyone has access to a mobile phone. It's like I kind of wag my finger and I say, no, actually, that's not true. It is astonishing how much mobile phone technology and access has spread around the world, but by no means can we say, quote, everyone has access to mobile phones and everyone knows how to use them. It's a very significant gap. It's also a very significant age gap, as we all know, because we all make jokes amongst ourselves about, you know, needing an 8-year-old to figure out how to use our internet systems. But it's certainly a big gender gap, pretty much in most places in the world.
It absolutely is. And on that note, right, we have to go on to the quiz, good people. Now, you will know that our Claire, who puts these quizzes together, she's pretty fiendish. Now, she told me, she says, Royfield, this time it's not so bad, right?
So, no, I didn't say that at all. you said one where you will have to guess rather than know the answers potentially, unless you happen to have a copy of the Women's Atlas in front of you, because that's where all the information comes from.
Now,
so, you know, if you've revised ahead of the time, then you're doing well. But no, it's educated guesses more than actual knowledge, I suspect.
Whoever wins this quiz not only gets bragging rights, but they also have the honour of doing next month's audio postcard, which of course on the video call is a video postcard. And I keep on saying this, but I will one day get round to uploading these all to YouTube, because these are wonderful things and they shouldn't just be left in audio form on the podcast. So question number one, sport. Which of these women's sports? Claire, come on now. We're British. I'm gonna read this again in the way it should have been written. Sport, which is single and plural. Which of these women's sport was the earliest to be included in the Olympics? Was it A, archery, B, swimming, or C, equestrian? Which of these women's sport was the first to be included in the Olympics? Was it A, archery, B, swimming, C, equestrian? question number one. Question number two, we're still on sport. Which country was the first to offer equal pay to its men's and women's national football teams? I know the answer to this. Is it A, Nigeria, B, Norway, or C, Nicaragua? Which of these was the first to offer equal pay to its men's and women's national football teams? Was it Nigeria, Norway, or Nicaragua? Question number three, we're on to politics. Which of these countries have a quota for women's representation in national governance? Is it A, China, B, New Zealand, C, India, or D, Saudi Arabia? Which of these countries have a quota for women's representation in national governance? Is it A, China, B, New Zealand, C, India, or D, Saudi Arabia? We're on.
And it might be more than one. That's the other thing to know.
Ah, thank you. All right, we're on to beauty. Which country has provided the most winners of Miss World? A, Venezuela, B, Australia, or C, Brazil? I think I know the answer to that. Not 100% sure. Read that one again. We're on to beauty. Which country has provided the most winners of Miss World? Is it A, Venezuela, B, Australia, or C, Brazil? Demography. The lowest birth rate in the world is 1.2 in Hong Kong, Portugal, Singapore, and South Korea. But which country has the highest birth rate at 7.6? Good heavens. Is it A, Niger, B, Burundi, or C, Mexico? The lowest birth rate in the world is 1.2, and that can be found in Hong Kong, Portugal, Singapore, and South Korea. But which country has the highest birth rate at 7.6? I also think I do know this one. Is it A, Niger, B, Burundi, or C, Mexico? Still on demography, women live longer than men, but which country has the highest life expectancy for women? Is it A, Chile, B, Hong Kong, or C, Italy? Women live longer than men, but which country has the highest life expectancy for women? Is it A, Chile, B, Hong Kong, C, Italy? Question number seven, religious freedom. Only one country has laws both requiring women to wear religious dress and prohibiting women from wearing religious dress. Which one? Is it A, Russia, B, Belgium, or C, Sudan? Religious freedom. Only one country has laws both requiring women to wear religious dress and prohibiting women from wearing religious dress. Which one is it? Is it Russia, Belgium, or the Sudan? And the last question is about finance. In most countries, more men than women have a bank account, but can you identify the country in the list where more women than men have a bank account?
Oh,
it's a daisy. Look at my answers.
All right, I can tell you it's A, Jamaica, B, Philippines, or C, Morocco.
Thank you for saving my blushes there, Claire. Can you give us those again?
Yeah. So in most countries, more men than women have a bank account. But which of the countries in this list are where more women than men have a bank account? Is it A, Jamaica, B, Philippines, or C, Morocco?
Thank you very much, Lee, Claire. And just before we go on to social media roundup, Ken has been bragging in the chat saying that he has rafted the tidal bore in Nova Scotia. It's a proper action man, our Ken. Ken, when did you do that?
Oh, that would have been in 2009. I was in Nova Scotia for a family reunion. The McDonald's lived in Nova Scotia before coming to the United States. And it was quite a thrill. I've done a lot of rafting on rivers in North Carolina. This was similar, except, you know, the water's flat until the tide starts coming in, and then you get the wild ride. We also did some mudsliding. You can go up on the banks. It's extremely muddy. It's just thick, gooey mud, and it's very messy, but you can slide in the mud kind of like sledding.
Wowza. thank you for that, Ken. We always like an action man to be part of proceedings here, because I tell you what, it ain't me. Now, Claire, social media roundup, what we got?
Alrighty, so it's been a little while since we've recorded, but I'm trying to catch up on some of some of what we've been doing over that time. On Twitter, there's been a few cool maps that have been shared there. Magic at Mungo's, Cursed Figures, has shared a couple. One that was really quite nice was, it's about lighthouses of Europe, but it doesn't just show you where the lighthouses are. In theory, it shows you the colour of the light that they flash and the speed at which they flash. Now, if you go into the thread below this, there's a whole lot of people complaining that you've missed this lighthouse or that lighthouse doesn't flash quite like that. And so, yeah, there's always a critic, isn't there? But actually, as a map, it looks so lovely because it's sort of twinkling around the coastlines in a really beautiful way. So that was pretty cool. And we actually had a map corner tagged a picture from Rosemary J. Brown, who's going to be our guest next month, looking at an illustration of Nellie Bly's Race Around the World Like Phileas Fogg. So that was really nice to see. And it was sort of map adjacent. I mean, you know how I sometimes push the boundaries on this, but there was an amazingly bonkers thread around Christmas time. This guy had posted, it was like they do like these, you know, they do like World Cup of when they sort of have like a knockout competition. And it was places in Nottinghamshire which sound like American golfers. Put it on the map corner hashtag. I can't begin to tell you. It's all sorts of fun. It's not really about maps. But it's place names. So, you know, it's kind of close. And some of the places in Nottinghamshire do sound like American golfers. What can I tell you? So that's one to look for. That was a lot of fun.
Is there a town called Fuzzy Zella in Nottinghamshire?
Not to my knowledge. You're going to ask me to find it now, aren't you? But it was a lot of fun. So I recommend going to look for that. If you're on Twitter on the hashtag Matt Corner, you can find that. The most active thread in our Facebook group, I'm sorry to say, Royfield, or maybe it's because of that, was the one that Karen Cunningham posted about the most attractive and least attractive accents around the British Isles, which identified Brummie as the least attractive accent and Southern Irish as the most attractive accent. Most regular listeners will not need to be told that Royfield is from Birmingham. So,
wait on a minute, Sarah Spilsbury. You know, I know technically you're not a Brummie, but
she's Black Country.
But yeah, we're putting you in the Brummie family here. How do you feel about this, Sarah? It's only what we've known anyway that people despise the way that we speak in the UK. What says you, madam?
That's fine. I'm within throwing distance of the boundary, and I work for the local authority. So yeah, I'll throw me lot in with Brum.
But how do you feel about this Brum hate that everybody has for us?
I think it's terrible.
It is. And like, considering that, you know, kind of linguists and whatever basically say that Shakespeare spoke like us, you know, so basically we can say that the English language comes forth from our accent. Just saying.
Yeah. Well, I
love listening to Alison Hammond. I could listen to her all day. It's a great accent. I'm baffled by that one. Sorry.
You know, to be fair to her, she's done quite a lot to rehabilitate the Brummie accent. And I'll go so far as to say that she's only one of two kind of national newsreader presenters that have a Brummie accent. The other one's Adrian Child. So having her on, it's making us socially acceptable to be put on broadcast media. So well done, Alison Hammond.
I mean, I am a sucker for a Southern Irish accent, though, so what can I tell you? Laura Munzer posted a fabric map of Africa showing sort of traditional fabric patterns and textile patterns from Africa. And I love those. I'm a sucker for a textiles map and a crafts type map. You know, it's such a beautiful thing. And even though you only see a picture of it, it almost feels tactile, that like you want to reach out and touch the different sorts of fabric and textile design. So I love that one. And also Sarah Spilsbury posted a couple of months ago something that came out of a conversation, not on a different group, which was around a map showing areas of the London Blitz and what happened and where the bombs dropped and what happened after. So you could sort of walk around London and see, yeah, where the bombs were, and that's fantastic living history when you can go back and walk those streets.
Can I just quickly jump in there, Claire?
Yeah.
Because the whole thing about, and I might have said this before on Matt Corner, I've got a feeling I said it on a podcast, but it, with the trained eye, the evidence of places which have been bombed in the Blitz is all around you in London. You've just got to be known what to look for. And one of the starkest examples that I was told, I used to live on a road called Torbay Road in Kilburn in London. And directly opposite, there was a house. And if you looked at the first floor or the second floor, if you're in North America, but first floor in the UK, the bricks halfway through were obviously newer. But it's only when you looked that you noticed it. And the lovely old lady who must have passed on now, who used to live next door to us, bar but one, so two doors down. One day I was talking to her and she says, oh, I remember the single lady that used to live there up until 1941, until the Germans bombed the house. And she said, oh, she was really nice. And she said, look at the bricks there. That's when in the 1950s, when they rebuilt the second floor of that house. And it was just such an amazing thing. Well, of course, you don't realize that all this evidence is actually around you. And then there was a story of the house opposite mine actually being bombed. And then eventually it was rebuilt in the 1950s. And this poor lady and her daughter lost their life, you know. And she'd lived in that house all of her life. She knew the story and she knew the woman. But anyway, yes. So thank you for that, Sarah, because it's an amazing thing to behold, you know, to have the map and to be able then to see maybe the gaps in development, or there's a newer building because actually that place was destroyed.
So yeah, and then one of the most recent threads on the group was, you know, triggered a lot of conversation, has been that the map that Stephen Noak originally posted to the Things That Made England podcast, which was around his personal experience of levels of friendliness around the UK. And he delivers cars for a living. So he's got around delivering cars to pretty much most places and has built up a kind of background over time. I'm very sad to say that Bedfordshire, where I live, is in the most unfriendly section of that map. So that's a bit sad. But yes, it's triggered all sorts of debate about whether people are just more friendly in the Northeast. I think that's what it's telling us. But
there's a little glob of friendliness around the West Midlands and Birmingham. Just saying, but not much friendliness around Bedfordshire. And I wonder.
No, we're a right cold bunch there. Yeah, we're the worst. But I did notice actually when we moved to Suffolk, which are in the neutral section, they were definitely more friendly than where we'd lived in Sussex before. So, you know, I definitely sense the difference there.
And can I just say for our North American friends who are listening and watching in on this Zoom and on this podcast recording, I can categorically tell you that as a bunch, North Americans are more hospitable than us Brits. Full stop, absolutely. If you want to be somewhere in the world and stuck at a bar or a coffee shop and not know anybody, you best do it in North America, because you'll make friends. People will actually take you in and show you around, as opposed to doing it in Bedfordshire in England, just saying.
Is that before or after you're drunk?
Actually, before.
Oh, I'd just be too horrifically British to want to strike up a conversation with anyone else anyway.
And that is the problem, and that's something which our North American friends aren't, you know, they're not inhibited by that, you know. No. Invariably, people are much more kind of like, hey, where are you from, where are you going, etc. So anyway, and on that note, I'll let you get on with the social media roundup, and I've interrupted.
That's about it. The only other one I was going to mention was Brett Watkins, who's our friend in Australia, had posted a map around odd place names in the UK, which is always, yeah, it's an old perennial map, but it's always good for a laugh around places with, you know, funny and rude place names. So that one's in there as well.
I saw an amazing map posted on Twitter, which was a fisher's view of the world. And it was a really cool Antarctica projection. And in fact, from the Southern Seas, the entire world is ocean. And so I'll pass it on to you. It was an amazing map.
Oh, we love a projection. Awesome. Yeah. Different projections are a lot of fun.
So now is the time for us to go through and to recount the answers of the quiz question.
I'm expecting Joni to get 8 out of 8 here, I think.
Well, that's the thing. Normally, Joni, I do kind of put our guests on notice that they should not embarrass themselves.
That's good notice.
All right. Okay. Question number one, sport. Which of these women's sport was the earliest to be included in the Olympics? What do you reckon, Joni?
Oh, it's archery.
And Claire, the correct question is?
The correct answer is archery, 1904, swimming, 1912, equestrian, not till 1952, which I find quite surprising.
I answering the quiz. I thought everyone else was going to be answering.
They're self-scoring, but we're just checking that you've actually read your own book. That's what we're doing, Joni. That's what we're checking. All right.
So yeah, I was really surprised it took till 1952 to include the horsey stuff, because you know you'd have thought that would be something that women were quite regularly doing back in the kind of 1900s, early turn of the century. And probably before swimming, I'd have expected. But there you go.
Yeah, swimming, me too. You know, riding side saddle and all of that. Right, question number two. Which country was the first to offer equal pay to its men's and women's national football teams? Now, if I'm correct, this only happened quite recently, but I think I know the answer. But Joni, what's the answer?
Oh, Norway, of course.
Absolutely Norway. Yep.
And very recently, now that I can't remember, but we could look it up.
2017.
Very quickly, recent. And in fact, it's still, as you know, in most sports, from local to global, it's still very controversial, the whole pay discrepancy between women athletes and male athletes in exactly the same sport. And the gaps are sometimes astonishing. I mean, astonishing gaps.
Trying to throw a little bit of positivity onto sport pay and coverage, the burgeoning coverage of women's professional football in the UK is something to behold. It's come from utterly zero to being televised on TV in less than 5 years. And the professionalism of that league is going through the roof. And these women they're not paid as much as the men, but they're now being paid, whereas just less than 10 years ago, it was all amateur. But we've got a long way to go. Question number three, politics. Which of these countries has a quota for women's representation in national governance? Joni, over to you.
Three cheers for India.
I did not know that.
Well, interestingly, because I've got the answers as China and Saudi Arabia. So...
Oh, my God.
Let me go back and correct the thing.
Oh, my God. Could it be an error? It could be. Although India had very early quotas. India is known for very early quotas, perhaps at the local level. So that's probably the difference at the local level for India. And they actually had a quota for 30% for village councils. It made a huge difference. So I see, according to my map, you're correct, Claire, but at the national level.
So Joni, you were wrong. You didn't read your book correctly, and Claire was right because you did read your book.
I didn't, Dave.
But I think India deserves an honorary mention because they do it at the local level. Yes.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
Okie dokie. Question number four, beauty. Which country has provided the most winners of Miss World? Would I be right if I said Venezuela?
I believe you're right.
You are right. It is Venezuela.
Okay. I can remember. Again, it just shows you how fast time is a ticking or how old I am. But I remember watching Miss World in the 1970s with my mum. And it was just something that you did. And by the early 80s, this was old fashioned. This was terrible. You just didn't do it. That thing fell out of favor so fast. But in the 1970s, it was much watched TV. When Jamaica won, my God, were us Jamaicans proud, right? Mm-hmm. So it was, you know, we're on the map. But also, though she didn't look stereotypically Jamaican, shall we say, but a woman from Jamaica could be seen as being beautiful throughout the world. You know, something to be incredibly proud of back then wouldn't fly now. You know, our mores have utterly changed. But I do remember that sense of my parents, because I was kind of too young been incredibly proud that somebody from Jamaica actually won. But anyway, Venezuela is the answer. Number five demography, the lowest birth rate in the world is 1.2. And we need, was it 2.1 just to sustain the population, don't we? Yeah, it's 2.1. So that's Hong Kong, Portugal, Singapore, and South Korea. But which country has the highest birth rate of 7.6? I believe it's Niger. Am I correct?
It is Niger. And it's pretty astonishing. That's a pretty astonishingly high birth rate. I just want to go back to beauty contests for one second, just to say that one of the really interesting things about just mapping beauty contests, which in itself might not be seen as a particularly interesting thing to do, but is to, you can actually see from the 80s moving forward, you can see the effects of globalization and formerly socialist or communist or kind of liberation states jumping on the global beauty bandwagon. China sending contestants to global beauty contests. Like, really? Are you kidding me? You know, Zimbabwe. I mean, it's just astonishing. So you can actually do a really nice time series of when governments, because it is governments after all, start sending or enabling contestants to be sent to these international contests. And it's a really interesting, unobtrusive measure of political economy shifts in the world.
I wonder if you could map those movements against Olympic participation as well, because again, that's kind of international stage where, you know, female participation has grown. And different countries take different perspectives about the appropriateness of female participation in certain sports. So, you know, it's an interesting if they'll let them go to the beauty contest, but not to participate in the Olympics, for example, or vice versa.
Very interesting. Yeah.
Mm. And just on that note, was it last year? Because whenever I go home and I'm at mum and dad's, they've got daytime TV on. I think they're the only people in the UK still watching TV, my mum and dad, you know, it's, you know, non-streaming TV. And Miss England, I believe it was, I don't know if it's Miss England or Miss United Kingdom, but she was black and she's the first woman last year to be Miss England or Miss United Kingdom. I forget which one it was. And she just talked about the level of support that she'd got, because she's broken through this perceived barrier, and B, the amount of racist vitriol, you know. And she was very positive about the whole thing, but she said that, you know, I have had a lot of people saying I shouldn't be there, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so Nigeria was the answer there. Demography back. Women live longer than men, but which country has the highest life expectancy for women? Joni, the answer is?
Hong Kong.
Maybe it's because they're having fewer babies. I don't know. Could be.
Right. Let's start making correlations here. And it's going up. I mean, the life expectancy, I think, for women in Hong Kong right now is 87, although I think I just heard that it's up to even 88, which is, you know, an extraordinary kind of high average. So.
Absolutely. And that's going to be interesting to see the impact of the pandemic, actually, because where, you know, we've had very different sorts of mortality rates across the whole world, but they also track absolutely existing inequalities and vulnerabilities. So, you know, so we might see life expectancy drop on that average because of that, but then, might, you know, it plays out differently, like you say. So, but, you know, there are, so Hong Kong's 87, Chile's 84.7, Italy's 85.7. So there's this thing about the Mediterranean countries, people living longer, and that seems to be borne out as well in the life expectancy data.
Religious freedom, question number seven. Only one country has laws both requiring women to wear religious dress and prohibiting women from wearing religious dress. Put my teeth in to say that. Which one is it? Is it Russia, Belgium, or Sudan? Joni, the answer is?
Well, it's Russia. And of course, we should put in actually some women in both of those because it's very local or regional. So for women in Chechnya, there's a local legislation that they must wear headscarves, whereas in some parts of Russia, the hijab is banned. It's not so much country level as it is a more local level, but really interesting, this whole controversy around women's dress and women's dress reflecting religious or ethnic identity. It's just such a mess. Once you start getting into it, it's like, oh, really? People, there's so much confusion about how how policymakers, as say from local to international level, want women to represent or not represent those backgrounds. It's like, wow, really interesting stuff.
Yeah. It was World Hijab Day this week. So I got involved. I saw some stuff on Twitter with some colleagues, you know, looking at how we were sort of celebrating, but it just caused a massive debate about, you know, well, yeah. You know, I know some amazing hijab wearing women, and then also I know some people who would like prefer that it wasn't, you know, enforced, right. But I don't know anyone who's in a forced situation, so you know, it's really tricky, but it's become such a visible expression that it leads to people being targeted, you know, and that's just, yeah, it's just such a shame.
Yeah.
And the last question, and the answer is not Buddhism, Christianity or Islam, right? But the last question is, it's finance. In most countries, more men than women have a bank account. But can you identify the one country in this list where more women than men have a bank account? And just run us through those answers again, Claire.
The options were Jamaica, Philippines and Morocco.
And Joni, you have the hot seat.
Oh, you know. I'm going to turn it back to you. I actually can't remember which of those places, but it's really interesting. The banking patterns are really kind of counterintuitive in many instances. I might guess that it's Morocco, but I'm not 100% sure.
Okay, so you've gone exactly the wrong way, Jenny, because Morocco is the place where there's the biggest banking gap between men and women. So
men have a bank account,
only 27% of women. And I have Moroccan, well, my ex-husband's Moroccan, so I have a Moroccan family-in-law, and he has seven sisters. So again, high birth rate. So, but they are all amazing women and they all have bank accounts. So like, it's really interesting. Actually, the answer is the Philippines. More women than men have a bank account in the Philippines. In Jamaica, it's about almost exactly the same. So it's like 1%.
I wonder what kind of bank accounts that those are.
Financial institutions. So again, it's this issue about how can you track people who are banking in or outside
informal.
I didn't realize how many central banks are issuing digital currencies now. And specifically, if you use Jamaica as an example, the Jamaican Central Bank is launching digital dollars this year. They trialed it last year. And one of the things which it will do will be to massively help rural populations so they don't have to go into town to go to ATMs, and it will stimulate rural economies. And specifically, the uplift will be, people think, with women, that women will actually not have to go through their husbands or the men, basically. The money will be on their phones, and it will actually be incredibly secure. So digital currencies could be something which helps level things up for women throughout the world. Mm. And specifically UBI in places like, it was trialed in Kenya, and the levels of female entrepreneurship went through the roof with women go on, Joni.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, I'm actually pretty familiar with Kenya, and the system is called M-Pesa. And you're right that its use has just been astronomically high. And I was actually, last time I was in Kenya, which was, I guess, 3 years ago, since then, no one's been going anywhere. But I was talking with someone in the one of the telecom companies, Safari Telecom, and she said one of the features that M-Pesa offers is same day lending of small amounts of money, you know. So if you're a market vendor and you need to pick up your products in the morning to sell them a little later that day, you can get, you know, the equivalent of a $3 or $4 or $5 loan that has to be paid back, online loan has to be paid back at the end of the day through the M-Pesa system. And she said the early morning is so, for same day lending, is so disproportionately high. Women are such a disproportionately high percent of them, because it's women who are small market vendors, and they wake up first thing in the morning and they take out a loan so they can buy their goods so they can sell them, and then they repay the loan 10 or 12 hours later. It's an amazing system.
Absolutely. I'm going to go on, good people, onto gallery view. I'm going to do in a time-honored fashion. So we had 8 questions. Did anybody get all 8 correct? If you did, please wave, jump up and down, whoop and holler, and say you are the one, you are the one, you are the one. Did anybody get all of these correct? 7 correct. 6 correct. Oh, wow. I feel a tiebreaker situation coming on here. 5 correct.
Nick Roworth.
No tiebreaker. Well done, Nick. Which ones did you get incorrect, sir?
I'm fully on mute. Got the India one wrong.
Well, you kind of got it right, really.
And the Hong Kong one and the Russia one. Which I was thinking of going for those, but I didn't in the end. So, yeah.
Well, I did say it was more educated guesses than anything else. So, you know, it's a bit of luck, really.
No, I knew the archery one.
well done, sir. So you've got to think what audio postcard you're going to do for. I've got a sneaky feeling, Nick, we have one saved up. But still, if you could do it in the next month, that'd be most awesome, just in case I'm wrong.
I've thought of something.
Brilliant.
I can't remember what it is, though, on the top of my head. I'll try and make it not so long as the last one.
Right, good people. I think we're just about done. So, Claire, is it time for us to hang up our maps, or do we have...
Not until I give you my map fact for the show.
Oh, yes, please. Yes, my favourite bit of the show.
Yeah, right, the bit you always forget. okay, so this time my map fact is staying with the women of mapping, and it is that the largest mappamundi, medieval mappamundi, is the Ebstorf map from 1234, and it was made by women, we think, nuns at Ebstorf in Germany, and it takes up 30 goat skins. And I hadn't realised there's over 1,000 mappamundi out there. I mean, I know about the one in Hereford. That's the one we hear about. But the Ebstorf map is another mappamundi, and there's loads of them. But that was the absolute biggest one. So well done, the nuns at Ebstorf in the 1230s for making the Ebstorf map.
Can I ask a really kind of like maybe stupid question? What if there are many mappamundis, what makes a mappamundi a mappamundi?
Well, I think it's that kind of... the thing about the mappamundi, it's a little bit more figurative, isn't it? It's sort of geographical, but they tend to centre around Jerusalem, as I recall, and they have east at the top, or they tended to have east at the top, and then they've got sort of, they sort of mix the biblical and the kind of earthly, in my experience, and I think that's true of this one. So I don't know. Maybe we should get someone in to talk about mappamundis, because I don't really know very much about it. I'll fool someone. We'll have them on a future podcast. Good idea.
I think one of the distinguishing characteristics is that it is of the world, which would be quite an accomplishment in particularly European medieval times when the world was not yet fully apprehended. So that's why it was a lot of imagination as well as some actual cartography. I think that's one of the key features, but I stand ready to be corrected.
Well, that sounds as good a hypothesis as any.
Yeah.
So there you go. So you could well end up being, Claire, that the expert you get on to explain why a mappamundi is Joni again. Just saying.
No. But I'm going to look it up afterwards.
Well, then you will be our expert. You've got to go careful there.
Well, I think we've given you a right royal hour plus of map corner action, everybody. So I really do think, Claire, it's time for us to fold up our maps, is it not?
It is time for us to fold up our maps. So, join us next month when we talk to Rosemary J. Brown about the travels of Nellie Bly. And, leave us a review, and it's time to fold up as well.
Smashing. So I'm just going to say thank you to Joni for being part of the recording. Not part of the recording, the centre, the pivot of which we've all just spun around in terms of this recording. It's lovely seeing you, Ken, Nick, Sarah, Andy, Jan from Dumdy Dum, Jennifer and Patty. Lovely seeing you all. And I'm most definitely going to fold up my map